Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the wonderful little island-chained nation paradise, where we have container ships that split in half on our reefs and contaminate entire beaches with oil and crusting stuff like that, and we drop poison called 1080, which is illegal everywhere on Earth except New Zealand for outdoor use, into our pristine bush that kills absolutely everything. You know, it's clean, it's green, and it's free. Alright? And it's certainly not corrupt, according to Transparency's International Corruption Perception Index, which is, of course, called a perception index for a reason, because it's not the reality. My very special guest today is a, he should be quite a famous New Zealand reporter, and in certain circles, I guess he is. His name's Ben Vigen, and he's the creator of Postman Productions. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. How you doing? I don't know if I'm famous, but I'm certainly infamous. They recently did a thing where they turn around and they discovered that the New Zealand Defence Force describes investigative journalists as subversive. So there you are, I'm officially on the wanted list.
Well, you know, you can't, shall we say, go out telling the truth and what have you without having some kind of recompense if you're actually telling the truth, right? Some people go out there, Ben, and they say, I'm telling the truth, but it's actually all BS, you know, like John Key. And, of course, no consequences for telling lies, but there's plenty for telling the truth.
Well, there is, and it's also quite interesting because, you know, over the years, I've reported on various things, and at the time, my colleagues have turned around and said, you're a conspiracy theorist, that's all rubbish. And inevitably, within sort of around about anywhere from 6 months to 3 years, everything that I would report on does actually come to fruition. So it's quite interesting, the fact that I keep getting it right, and no one turns around and says, wait a minute, he got that right. Maybe we should listen to him this time. But, you know, that's, of course, because what I'm saying is against the status quo, and the status quo doesn't like to be shown up.
Well, wouldn't you say that part of the reason why these alleged credible journalists would criticise you and call you a conspiracy theorist and then not come out when you turn out to be right and say, hey, well, actually, you were right, is it's not because they're not saying or they don't think that you were correct, it's that they don't want to admit that they were wrong.
Yeah, well, that's highly likely the case. And, you know, down here in Dunedin, throughout the rest of New Zealand, we're facing an issue of drilling off the oil off New Zealand, which is, you know, one of those examples, because you can go back as far as 2003 with my second book, State Secrets 2, and I pointed out the fact that, you know, we had oil in the Southern Basin and this was going to be a major player in our geopolitics in the coming decade. At the time, people said, no, we don't, that's all rubbish now, that's just nonsense. And, of course, you know, now we've got oil survey ships left, right and centre. And no one seemed to answer, well, wait a minute, at a time when we were saying that there's no oil, he was saying that we do, maybe we should listen to him. And, you know, that's for obvious reasons, because the majority of the media in this country have their advertising from big business, and big business is connected to these larger groups that basically what I'm saying that people are listening to, we wouldn't have them here in the first place. Case in point, Anadarko Oil, if you go to the United States and you look at mainstream media, Wall Street Journal, CNN, they'll point out the fact that Anadarko, which is a company that we want to lead into, Otago, has been a reputable, great company, that this is a company that's actually currently facing up to a $40 million lawsuit for setting their firms up in such a way that if things do go wrong, they don't have to pay the damages. It hasn't been mentioned in not one single mainstream outlet today. And this is, you know, this is in New Zealand. All you have to do to find out that information is Google onto the mainstream in the US, but gosh darn it, our fingers of our journalists seem to be broken. They can't use Google.
Mm-hmm. Anadarko seems more like Anarko.
Yes, they do.
Maybe even just a little bit Unco, because they drilled a well that they didn't produce anything, didn't they?
Well, I mean, that's again another interesting point, because back in 77 we were drilling for oil with the Hunt brothers down here, and number one is, you know, they clapped up that well. We knew that there was oil there, and as, you know, events happening now show the fact that there is oil. They chose not to say it was empty because, of course, at the time they didn't want to share that wealth with other people and were hoping to get their stocks in order and come back, but, of course, they fell over. Anadarko right now potentially could be in exactly the same situation. You know, with that $14 billion, they're not getting a lot of investors into doing these sort of projects. So, you know, Taranaki's come to a halt. Raglan's come to a halt. They've just brought their ships back from Pegasus Bay. So you've got to question the fact of what's going on here, because, you know, they all went off on a hiss and a roar and everyone was rolling out the red carpet for them, and now they're sort of going, well, oh, they're finding ways not to do it. So, you know, my suggestion is we might actually win this one simply because Anadarko messed up in the United States and the roosters are coming home to bite them.
Well, one should hope. The question is, of course, does New Zealand play a much larger role in the international syndicate, the Anglo-American New World Order? Do we actually, as a country, hold any strategic significance for military operations in the South Pacific?
We hold massive amounts of strategic significance, and I'll just round you for five off the top of the head. First of all, New Zealand is based off the Pyramidic Trench, and this is a deep trench that runs from basically New Zealand to Hawaii. In the event of a nuclear war, what happens is the attack submarines come out of Pearl Harbor, they fire their missiles, they go to that trench, they rush down to New Zealand. So we're basically the gateway to what they call Submarine Alley. Of course, the other thing is, if you want to get the control of the mineral resources in Antarctica, there's basically four points in the southern hemisphere that you can jump from, which is sort of South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and Chile. But New Zealand's the only place where you can run air-base operations for about 4 to 6 months of the year. So again, we're a gateway to Antarctica. We're right in the middle of South America and Australia. So again, if you look at the map of the world, we're a very strategic naval port. And of course, with the situation of climate warming, if you subscribe to that viewpoint, what would happen, of course, is that New Zealand, being a country that's surrounded by water, would be cooled down. It would be one of the few places in the world where you can effectively actually have a proper agricultural economy. So again, the strategic significance of this piece of real estate is increasingly becoming more and more important. And that's something which I managed to put to the then Minister of Science and Technology, that Labor government, just told me, Peter Hodgkins, and, you know, Peter Hodgkins said, well, actually, I think you've got a point there. So, you know, it's not just my viewpoint. The Chief Minister of the Science and Technology saw my logic and agreed with me.
If that's the case, then, if we hold such strategic significance, it would occur to me that international agendas would be at play to more or less take control of this country, usually by economic means, first of all, and then once you've controlled the entire country's economy, you no longer have to worry about who's in charge.
Well, that's what the OPAL file, which is you just can Google the OPAL file, Aotearoa, New Zealand, very old document, it's been around since the 1980s. One of the things that Richard said, there was oil, and everyone laughed at it, but today if you pick up a piece of document, you go through it, which is what I've done, and I've used archive methods, the newspapers, declassified material, most of that document can verify, which basically says, you know, back as far as 1975, they saw the strategic importance of New Zealand, and they've been moving their guys and taking up key positions ever since. And of course, you know, fitting with naval doctrine as well. The United States Pentagon's own press release to say that, you know, by 2020 they want to have 6% of the U.S. naval fleet stationed in the South Pacific. So again, in that context, our significance becomes increasingly important.
So how exactly are they planning to economically take us over then, if that is the case? We have oil drillings and all of that coming in. I was speaking to a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, Ben, and he was working in Vietnam during the mid to late 90s, and he was doing a bit of consulting and talked to a Chinese diplomat who he believed to be really corrupt. And that Chinese diplomat told him that New Zealand is one of the major targets for China. And he claimed or alleged that China was getting a lot of its quote-unquote undesirables, you know, people who might go to camps or be executed and what have you, shoving a quarter of a million or $1 million in their pocket, clearing their records, sending them to New Zealand so that they can buy up homes and businesses. And the hope was, at least according to this diplomat, that eventually New Zealand would wind up being owned by China.
Well, you're throwing a lot of stuff in there, but I'll try and follow. First of all, if you look at the Australian Defence White Papers, the terminology they refer to in terms of New Zealand is that we're basically a frontline territory for, quote unquote, the coming war with China. So even the Australian diplomats, you know, support that that belief system. As far as the immigrant situation goes, well, they're actually doing it sort of a number of places: New Zealand, Australia, Canada. But you know, it's funny you should mention Vietnam, because we had our office there that dealt with immigration, and the guys that were actually doing it were a company called Vostok Services. They were operating out of the New Zealand consulate in Vietnam. The guys, Ian Robinson, also owned a bank in Auckland called Proc Bank, which was actually co-run by the Russian mafia. Most of the cohorts he was working with in Vietnam were with Russian mafia. And of course, that same company, which they also were involved with the MILF deal, the Food for Oil program. And you know, this is a dodgy Russian company that's helping handling our immigration issues. And of course, if you look back at virtually every single immigration minister that we've had in the last 15 years, you know, there is a strong case in every single one of them to link them to organised crime. My first book, State Secrets, actually, in fact, you know, does that, goes through effectively every single one we had up until, I think it was John Tummy. No, I can't remember. Philip, anyway, the last Labour-based Minister of Immigration, I have, you know, a fairly list of all of them in there. And, you know, basically what they've done is, step one, to go back to what you're saying, is they've moved into New Zealand, they've bought up key positions or influence within both political parties and major corporations and now councils and university infrastructures. Step two, that they turn around and they wage the war. There's a book called The Rise and Fall of Briley's Investment, which, for your American listeners, this was a major New Zealand corporation. What they did was they lured Briley's overseas. They had them invest with all this cash stocks into fairly dubious investments. In 95, Arms Risk Management, which was another Australian firm linked to another guy from the Australian in the Food for Oil, that collapsed. That set off the collapse of banks. All those investments were sucked up, and Briley's investment went from being a company that was cash rich to suddenly it was heavily in debt. And effectively what they did was they lured these companies into debt, and then they just took them actually over. So that was the second stage. And if you follow that progression through, you've got companies like South Canterbury Finance can be seen having fallen to the same trap. And in my book, State Secrets 2, in 2006, I went into South Canterbury Finance's headquarters in Christchurch by the Bridge of Remembrance. I took a photograph of the foyer of the building. I went through all the companies in that building. I listed the company records, who the directors were, and then I vetted them in terms of, you know, were they in the newspapers for embezzlement, arms running, connections to the spy industry. The whole building was absolutely raft full of corrupt figures. So, you know, by 2006, I was pointing the finger at this company saying, it's dodgy. Everyone's going, no, South Canterbury Finance is such a nice company. It's run by such a nice gentleman. No, you're mistaken. And of course, then they turn around and they fell over. Step three is the trickier part, which is when we start getting into the issues such as the earthquakes, which, as you know, I've campaigned quite strenuously to point out the fact there's a lot of signatures that the device HAARP was used before the first and second earthquakes. The most significant issue about all of that is that one of the things I pointed out was during that the first and second earthquakes. Are you there? Are you there?
Yeah.
Just having a bit of interconnection problem last year, but okay. During the first and second earthquake, I pointed out that one of the symptoms of there being a strong electromagnetic influence in the atmosphere was a series of fireballs. For example, on the Boxing Day in the Christchurch Press of that day, there was a fireball on the front page. I was actually on Facebook saying, hey guys, you know, when you add all the other factors that are involved, and when you look at this, looks like we could be in for another earthquake. Bang, that afternoon we got hit. I did that again recently. We just had the stranding of a whole bunch of whales here up in the top end of the southern hemisphere. The top part of South Island, in conjunction with the earthquake lights that were roaming up and down the countryside and that have now only just been acknowledged by the media as existing. 2 years ago, they said, no, that's not true. Now they're saying, actually, I'm right that earthquake lights do exist. This recent earthquake in Wellington, day beforehand, we had whales washing up, we had these lights striking. I even turned around and said, this will actually happen in the North Island. Bang. Happen again. So far my call rate on that's been about 4 to 5, or 80% of the time I've turned around and said, look, all these factors point to me that there's our atmosphere is charged, and wham, next couple of days it happens. So, you know, what they've done is they've attacked our infrastructure, they've again moved their people into this, they've used it to change legislation. They're putting the pieces in quite nicely. And I know for a lot of people that's fringe, so be it. I go back to all my other cases that I've reported on and said, look, I was right about this. I can show you from 1993 when I've been reporting on this, all the background science, case histories behind HAARP, the fact that I called it with the Indonesian earthquake, I've called it with New Zealand earthquakes. You know, after a while, when you start seeing the same person on the same logistics, the same hardware, you kind of start to think this is a little bit more than a coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're not supposed to believe in coincidence, are you?
And of course, you know, the last one, which unfortunately I haven't had a chance to run through my entire checklist, but we've just actually had 9 orca whales stranded up on Southland as well. So it will be interesting from that viewpoint to sort of go online to things like the Meteorological Service, see that we're having reports of these sonic booms and aurora borealis activity in the sky, to see if there are any cases of light aircraft suddenly falling out of the sky, to see what other personnel or hardware are in place at that time. One of my lives, I used to be what they call an artillery intelligence operator, and the laws remain the same. Whether a pea shooter or an atom bomb, any weapon has a forensic signature. When you see the same signatures occurring, and you trace them back to the same point, and you see the same personnel, and you see the same money trail, then that's when you write a note to the boss and say, this is the kind of cannon I think they're using. And this is basically what I'm doing. I'm using the same methodology I was trained in the Army with HAARP, and basically... you know, my results are speaking for themselves.
Mm. So,
can I just interject? You know, it's a really tricky one for me because HAARP is not a subject that wins you any friends, and certainly a lot of people in the mainstream media think, well, you're tinfoil conspiracy stuff when you say this. So, I do this knowing that this is not going to get me an award, or I'm not going to be driving a Ferrari, but I do it because my conscience won't allow me to do it otherwise.
Yeah, I think it's actually a very similar reason to what I was doing. And one of my listeners asked me, you know, Vinny, why do you keep doing this? You know, why do you keep putting yourself through it? And I go, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we may not win, you know, that's basically, you know, I'm kind of resigned to failure, but I'm going to keep doing it anyway, not because I think that there's a victory capable of happening for me or whatever, but just because it's the right thing to do. Now, we may achieve victory, we may wind up exposing all of the scumbaggery and people will stop listening to lies and BS and what have you, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
The probability is that we are not going to win in yours or my lifetime, and this is the thing, is that this is a war. We are in a battle right now. This battle is stacked heavily against us, and the chances are we are not going to win this battle. But hopefully by keeping that flame alive and by providing information to the next generation, we give them the tools to dig deep. We're in a similar situation, I guess, to 1938 France, where we're the ones actually being the canaries in the cage. We will be the ones that get rounded up and taken out the back shot, while others get the chance to use that information to prepare themselves. And those are the ones that you don't hear about. They are out there. They're doing lots of good work, but their time is yet to come.
Mm. It comes onto a point of moral obligation, I think. Now, when we talk about this country, New Zealand's actually quite significant, as we've pointed out, in terms of strategically speaking. We're also untapped resources. We've got quite a lot of those, don't we?
We do have a lot of those resources, and again, it's an interesting situation because if you go back as far as 1905, I used to have a book in my position called Oil Fields in New Zealand, H.D. Reid. It was the official Crown survey of New Zealand's oil potential. The opening sentence of that book said that we have more oil than the whole Commonwealth combined. Pre-World War I, the whole issue of New Zealand oil resources came available. Became a topic. It didn't get developed because World War I saw the capture of territories in the Middle East, which meant that they didn't need to harvest these areas. The same thing happened in World War II. 1970, we had the issue came up. OPEC came through. And this is an interesting one, too, that a lot of people don't know. When the Hunt brothers were developing oil down here, our government turned around and asked for 25% royalties, which is pretty much unheard of. But at the same time they were doing that, Adnan Khashoggi, a very famous figure who acts as the spokesman for the OPEC oil cartel, who at that stage were trying to create a monopoly in conjunction with Standard Oil and the big boys to control the oil markets. He came to our Prime Minister. He said, look, here's the deal. If you leave your oil in the ground and change your investment law so that we can start buying up your territory, we will open our markets to you in the Middle East. Now, at that point, our entire exports from New Zealand to the entire continent of the Middle East were less than $4 million New Zealand dollars. By 1980 alone, we were exporting more than $400 million to Iran. And the bridging finance of all the what we call in New Zealand the Think Big projects, which were designed to make us an industrial country, but that's actually just put us into debt, that all came through Adnan Khashoggi's bank. Again, this is in the open files, and it's only now, in the last 2 years, that information is now verifiable via public sources. And in my case, my secondary source, that was actually Richard White on Radio New Zealand, confirmed my assumptions about Khashoggi being the bridging for Think Big were correct.
Well, what's the significance precisely? I mean, that's something that's going on. Do they have further plans, and what's the end game on that?
Well, again, it's interesting when you look at the players at the time. Like in 1977, what we did was we were like most countries. We had a 12-mile limit in terms of all the resources in that area was what we could mine, fish, etc. At that time, our farmers, you could sell milk to whoever they like. They could sell it at the gate. Our fisher guys could sell it to people driving past on the road. They had little caravans started up inside the coastline. Well, when we turned around and we said, look, we'll go for steel, we brought them what we or the economic exclusion zone, which then meant that 200 miles of territory we were claiming, the only way we could get this through at the United Nations is with the support of China, Russia, and most of the major players, with the exception of the US, on condition to us also bringing what we call the Economic Exclusion Act, which basically meant that these companies could now come into New Zealand and do joint ventures with us. Now, one of the main steps at the same time was Sir Douglas Goodwin, who founded what they called Amalgamated Dairies and Sanford Fisheries, he got involved. He basically set the ball rolling. Well, you look what happened to Amalgamated Dairies. Amalgamated Dairies became the New Zealand Dairy Board, which was basically a loose co-op. New Zealand Dairy Board became Fonterra, which became a full-on monopoly. So today, you can't buy milk off a farmer. You have to go to Fonterra. They set the price. We've got massive amounts of cows in New Zealand, but New Zealand, it's cheaper for a farmer to go and buy Coca-Cola than it is for him to buy milk in his own dairy. Interesting thing, too, is that the term amalgamated dairies was a term that Lenin himself used, and it was used to divide the method by which bourgeois farmers would be pushed off their farms and forced into a state collective via the creation of a debt cycle. And this is exactly what happened with the dairy farmers in New Zealand. I've always found this quite funny because, again, another one of my lives was I used to work as a researcher for Westpac in Australia. We got given a magazine at one stage in the early 90s, and it was called Globalism for Bankers, and it had a picture of Lenin's head being dismantled and basically described globalism or what we call free trade associated with the TTTPA or Trans-Tasman Pacific Agreement. It described globalism as a free trade where it was all about capitalism. But to make this happen, you had to have a fair and level playing field, which would be centralized and overseen by these wise guys that would be made up of bankers, academics, and industrialists. Well, I burst out laughing when I read this because my degree is in political science, and if I had to write an essay on what was the difference between Marx and Lenin, I would say, well, basically, Marx never defined who the Central Committee should be made up of. He just sort of loosely defined it as kind of a benevolent cross between the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, and Father Christmas. It was Lenin who turned around and defined that the Central Committee of the Politburo should be basically made up of these people that are backed by bankers, industrialists, and academics. In other words, the very formula for what we associate globalism or what we call super capitalism today. So left wing, right wing, the same turkey. You know, we use these words, but they really at the end of the day boil down to the few controlling the many.
Yeah, it's like atheism and Bible bashing. You'll notice that some people will go from hardcore Bible basher, never will listen to anybody about anything, you know, that kind of thing. The Bible's everything there is to know. And then they have some kind of an awakening, and then they become a full-on atheist, and they never listen to anybody or anything because they think they know everything and that science is their God. And then they'll have an awakening at that point in some point as well, and then they'll become a hardcore Satanist. And then they'll never listen to anybody because nothing else. You see what I'm saying? And that's the way they
can't. Their methodology never changes.
It's the way that they capture people by providing these little outlets, more or less, politically speaking. And if you can do that, if you can manipulate people effectively enough through the use of propaganda and sophisticated mind control like public school, you can wind up actually having a massive quantity of control over everybody by controlling both of these sides of the arguments that they'll gravitate towards as soon as one side of the argument disillusions them.
It's basically what you're dealing with. It's a divide and conquer methodology. And, you know, if you look at this model in terms of a macro model in terms of global affairs, or you want to look at it from a micro level in terms of looking at council politics, it's the same methodology. You know, I'll bring it back to my local bit of the world. Here in Dunedin, we have the issue of two camps. We have the pro-oil camp, or as they like to call themselves, the pro-gas camp, and we have the Otago Oil Free camp. Now, these are two people that are arguing, and that this creates a division within the community. While this division is going on, what they're not actually looking at is the fact that, you know, this pro-gas camp, this issue is actually being peddled by central government. And while central government's turning around and saying, hey, guys, you've got to have oil, and this is really going to be good for your economy, they're actually doing things like they're shutting down our engineering factories here in Dunedin. They're shutting down our science research facility, Invermay. That's 85 jobs, $100 million a year for Dunedin, which is a college town, so it's a big deal. And all the way, what they're doing is they're shutting these things down and centralizing it. So while we argue over oil and gas and we're a diverse community, we're not pushing forward what we need to, the government's stepping in and just closing down things and creating the game so that wealth centralizes into them. The same thing that's happening to government here, to the local government, is now happening to our New Zealand. We get divided between this Labour, National arguments, and we argue over these fairly trivial issues while we ignore the fact that basically the power within us has been centralized into global bodies such as the Trans-Tasman, you know, Tasman Pacific Agreement.
TPPA.
I hate that word.
Trans-Pacific.
It's mostly loaded. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking more like it's a the way I remember TPPA is it's a toilet paper public address.
Yeah.
All right.
And you know, so all these things are actually going on, which, you know, it's centralization of the power. And at the end of the day, like, I don't like using the word Illuminati, New World Order. Again, I find them very emotionally loaded terms. But the reality is, if you boil it down to basic statistics, in 1980, loosely, the world's resources were concentrated in the hands of 90% of the world's population. 90% of the world's resource was in the hands of 10%. By September 11th, we were looking at basically 95% of the world's wealth in the hands of 5%. We're now looking at that figure. It's growing to 99% in the hands of 1%. So whatever wording you want to use, the reality is that wealth is going to become into a more centralized source of people. You know, every year it becomes the few having more, and basically passing on conditions to us, which basically make us slaves on our own planet.
Have you ever seen somebody play a poker game where they've got the small stack of chips and somebody else has an enormous stack of chips, and you know for a fact that it's not possible for that person with the small amount of chips to compete because he's just going to be outbid and destroyed? Yeah?
Yeah, that's us.
Yeah.
And it's a really, I mean, I guess when you're faced with those situations, you have to go into part of yourself, which for me is, you know, I'm a very left-brain guy, I'm not very much into spiritualism, but the reality is when you realize that, you've also got to take into account that we are just one speck in this great huge cosmos. And, you know, what happens in 10 years or 100 years on this planet really isn't that much in the greater scheme. So at the moment, those guys have got all the chips. We've got few chips. It's probably that we're going to lose the next few hands because that's just basic maths. But the reality is, these guys also, if you look across the history, they are the most self-destructive body that ever comes about, and they always sink their own game. You know, even when they're winning, they somehow manage to mess it up for themselves. And I think, you know, we're just going to hold the line, be true to ourselves, and, you know, that's what inevitably will actually happen. And the world is a cycle. You've seen it happen millions of times where huge empires have come about and then they've just collapsed. And that's it. They get too top-heavy and they just fall over.
Well, and here's the question, though. Do those collapsing societies only collapse on the public face so that the people who are running it from behind the scenes can make off with all the wealth and then start up another one?
I think there's a very strong argument to be made for that. And it's, don't even, you know, worry about this particular current global collapse. You can go all the way back to pre-World War II or the Great Depression. I think it was Stock Question of 1928. Again, there's plenty of resources available now to also our universities that show pretty much all that the main players knew beforehand and were actually pulling the resources out of the market. I can't remember which particular magnate it was, but he turned around with the quote, as he says one day, I was having my shoes polished and the shoe boys started to give me stocks. It was at that point that I knew it was time to get out of the market. These guys have access to a huge amount of resources. They always know where the game's going. And if you talk about things like, you know, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve is a private body, and it's a revolving chair. So the same people in companies like Goldman and Sachs also work in the Federal Chair. They're not going to sink their own pals. You know, they're not going to sink their golf buddies. They're going to turn around, warn them in advance, allow them to act accordingly. The bailout turns out happens. What happens? Does the government turn around and take away a whole bunch of people and arrest them for, you know, dodgy dealings? No, it gives them bonuses and it lets them to keep trading. It's us that get penalised for their mistakes.
And occasionally they throw out like one kind of person or whatever and just go, see, this is the guy that's done all the bad stuff. Yeah. Throw him in jail and everything will be solved. And of course, everything just gets way significantly worse because often the person that they threw out was somebody who was trying to change the system for the better.
I think, you know, I sort of slightly change subjects on you a wee bit, but, you know, it's been going around my head a wee bit for a while. It's like, to be honest, I don't really care to do much of a rat's ass what the human race do. We're creatures of our own. We made this step, and we sat back and chose not to do anything. What annoys me is that we forget we share this planet with over 22 million other species that have every right to have an existence, and we are messing it up for them. And there are lots, even if we survive, and I really do believe the human race is resourceful, and we will get through this, but in doing so, we will be guilty of, I don't even know what the word for us beyond genocide, but we will be guilty for wiping out so many fellow sentient beings. And, you know, it really just breaks my heart when I think about it. And it's, you know, I'm a left-brain person, I deal on land-based issues, but, you know, I turn around and see these orcas that are washed up today, and I look at the fact that there's, in New Zealand, a country that prides itself being on clean and green. You know, within 30 years, we've gone from ponds that are hundreds are large to now they're down to tens. And within my lifetime, these species will be gone. And that's as a result of, directly as a result of these guys' psychopathic greed.
Mm. You do have a great point there, and I think the word you're looking for is extermination, right? And
global extermination.
Yeah, and it's kind of like in War of the Worlds when they say this is no more of a war than there is a war between men and maggots. And it occurs to me that it's not necessarily the human race's fault that we haven't done anything, because we've had a system that's been set up to us by people who are very, very well versed at manipulation, who are far more resourceful than people give them credit for sometimes, yeah. who have figured out a way to educate people so that anything that's real appears insane, and anything that's totally insane appears perfectly reasonable. And suspicion is looked upon as insanity. Being spiritual is looked upon as a weakness, and all of these sort of things. It's basically the only way they've managed to turn the world into the exact opposite of what it really should be is to teach everybody the exact opposite way that things should be and make them believe it.
Exactly. One of my most favorite and sacred books of all is a book by an author called Arthur Kessler, and it's called The Call Girls. I cannot stress it enough for anybody out there. You know, what everything you said is in this book, and he wrote this book in the early 70s. He highlighted these think tanks that the elite rate and how how much they plan in advance, the details of which they go about, their methodologies. It's a little book. It's less than 100 pages. It makes an excellent read. But you know, everything in that book was based on true facts, and he makes that point very clearly in the beginning of the book. You know, you can go back to Orson Welles. There's so many writers and filmmakers in the 1950s that were telling us this right back at the end of World War II, when you had all these symposiums being held to look at the issues of global population growth, resource shrinking. You know, these guys back in the 1950s were spending money studying it, researching, discussing it, putting their plans in actions, while most of the world had no idea that any of this was going on. Today, circa 50 years later, we get a few people that start to form little symposiums that, you know, dig into their pockets for pocket money. They aren't trained in methodology. They don't have the fuller picture. You know, it's like watching ants compete against an elephant.
You do have a point there, and what I've found interesting about your analogy, though, is that if enough ants crawled over an elephant, they'd not only drive it mad, but they'd eventually get it killed.
And you have hit the nail on the money. And I've given you all the doom and gloom, so now it's time to give you guys the positive spin. Yes, about last week I had the privilege of interviewing a guy called Andrew McMaguana, M-W-A-N-G-U-R-A. They call him the Pirate Whisperer. He is the founder of an organization called the East African Seafarers Association. Now, this is a man that is highly educated, that has worked in over 47 countries in the world. He chose to go back to Kenya, where he lives in a hut that has no electricity. His entire operation began with a cell phone. To this day, if you want to turn around and find out anything that's happening in the area in relation to maritime matters from Johannesburg to Dubai, this is the man you come to. And this is, you know, you've got Hollywood, you've got reporters, you've got spies, you've got diplomats, you've got gun runners, you've got everyone when it comes to this guy, because he's the ultimate clearing guy. What this guy does is he does not judge anybody. He simply gets information and passes it along, and the power which he has in unifying and creating resources for the ship workers and the maritime workers of Kenya is just phenomenal. By not pointing the finger at anybody, he never points the finger at anybody. He is the ultimate negotiator. He always goes, what is our common ground? How can we find common ground? And from this, take all the ants and build them so that they are one. I rank this man as, I mean, this guy has changed my life. And I rate this man right up there with Nelson Mandela. And there's a very good reason why Samuel Jackson's about to make a movie on this guy's life. Now, the point I'm making is he's living proof that one person can make a difference. And the Kenyan government had gone after this guy time and time again. But because of his position and his ability to build bridges and find common grounds, he is protected. And this guy sets a systematic, a role model for all of us to do. We need to go out there, connect, find people, not on Facebook. I mean in your communities, I mean in your country. Find people that are doing clever things without ego, with humility, and work together. Because you're right, Vinny, we outnumber these guys 1,000 to 1. And once we start to realize that, these guys stay outnumbered. So, yeah, they're going to win a few poker games, but this game is by far not over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you are taking out a target, it's best to aim at the right target. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. I think people have gotten overtly obsessed with the symptoms of the New World Order rather than the individuals who are putting it into place. Like, for example, I'm just going to come out and say I hate and fear police, especially the New Zealand police, namely because they hurt you for no good reason. They arrest you unlawfully and kill people and get away with it.
I had the most fantastic police experience this New Year's Eve. I got arrested on New Year's Eve. Would you like to know what I got arrested for?
Having an elevated mood level?
I got arrested for reporting a crime. And I've never, quite frankly, had so much fun in all my life. I won't go into full details, but basically we entered into a bar. My friend had her handbag stolen. I tried to basically get assistance from the manager and the security. When that didn't work, I tried to approach a police officer. New Year's Eve, a whole octagon full of drunken adults, and the police officer was choosing to concentrate on the four kids at the top of the octagon that were doing nothing but watching the adults make idiots of themselves. I tried to say, look, you know, I need your assistance. There's something happening right now. We can get these guys. The guy wouldn't listen. In the end, he basically said, if you don't go away, I'm going to arrest you. And I said, what, for reporting a crime? You're under arrest. Turned around, let him put his hands, you know, I cooperated the whole way through, let him put my hands behind my back, cuffed me, made sure it was double tight, slammed me against the paddy wagon, took me downtown, got out of the paddy wagon. I said, okay, guys, I've never been arrested before. You know, I don't want to cause you. I want to make your night smooth as possible. You know, tell me what the protocol is, and I'll just go along with you. So I spent the entire evening, well, about an hour and a half, basically cooperating with them. But at the same time, I was also doing, you know, I was cooperating with them, but I was also basically making them aware that they didn't have the power. And, for example, at one stage when the guy was writing stuff down, his hand was starting to shake because he was starting to realize that he wasn't quite dealing with the normal character. And he turned around and said, what do you do for an occupation? And I said, in a deadpan voice, I'm a journalist. You should have seen his pen. It just like shot off the paper. And I said, what's the matter, mate? Have you got Parkinson's disease? Your hand's shaking. And his friend turned around to me, or his partner turned around to me and said, you know, you don't know when to leave it alone, do you? And I said, look, at the end of the day, I'm cooperating. I'm more than happy to see how this rolls out in a court case. I'm fully aware of what I have and haven't done. And, you know, I'll let the chips fall where they are. This is not South Africa. I am not Stephen Biko. So at this end of the day, yeah, I'm going to turn around and call you guys out because you've messed up. Meanwhile, while this was going on, the desk sergeant upstairs was starting to piece things together because it turned out that I wasn't the only person who had their bag stolen. Within half an hour, they were dealing with about 5 cell phones that had been stolen. So, you know, I'm dealing with this police officer, and there's an ever-increasing rank of police officers coming through that have got – the first one had one stripe on his shoulder, and the next one had 2 stripes on the shoulder, and the third one had pips on the shoulder, and they're all looking at my paperwork. And basically, then the chairman and said, look, you know, we made a mistake. We're dreadfully sorry about this. Have a good night and let me go. But it all
happened. A mistake, my ass.
His next word was, thank you. He rang me up half an hour later and said, thank you for being a good sport about it. And the point I'm making, Ben, is that I didn't lose my cool. I knew that at the end of the day, like, you know, the cops tend to forget. They think they're the only badge in town. Well, I've got a press badge and I know how to use it, you know. And at the end of the day, I kept my cool. I didn't give them any grievance to up the ante. I knew the system well enough. And at the end of the day, they backed off because they were outgunned and they knew it.
But did the officer who arrested you and, I think, kidnapped you and assaulted you, I think would be the technical terms here, did he receive any of any kind, I mean, discipline?
No, of course he didn't. You know, and
so you didn't win. You didn't win. Well, you just didn't get locked up. You just didn't get locked up for life for nothing.
Well, actually, no, Vinny, I did win on a number of levels. Was number one, I managed to get a point through to him. I said to him, "Look, you've got to understand that when you deal with people, because I was with my partner, she was in a state of agitation. So when you deal with people, you've got to realize that people have experiences before they encounter you, and if you're under stress, they're likely to act in post-traumatic, you know, in a traumatic, which means they're not giving you the best. You've got to take that on board." And he turned around to me and said, "You're right. You know, I've actually," and basically, all the three primary police officers I was dealing with that night, they walked away, basically congratulating me for what I was doing. And I felt that I won friends that night. So, you know, the cops are not our enemy. They're just people that need to be re-educated. And at the end of the day, when the stock market crashes and these guys lose their pension, they're the ones that we need to get on our side because they're the ones that know the system.
Actually, my point was, when we started off on this whole thing, and I'm very sorry that it happened here, was that all they are is the front line. Okay, they're the cards. They're the backs of the cards. You don't know what's behind the cards. You don't know what kind of hand they're holding and what have you. There's a player holding all of those cards, okay? I'm not saying go after the frickin' jacks and the kings and the aces. Go after the person who's holding the whole frickin' deck, the whole stacked deck. Now, if we're talking about corruption, and this is kind of what's happening in this country at, in my opinion, an alarming rate, is an enormous increase in the incidence of corruption, not only in private companies and what have you, but also in the public sphere as well. We've got this.
Oh, look, it's.
Go ahead.
It's systematic throughout the system. And to give you another localized example, we have just had a series of dramas occur within our hospitality bar scene, which has emerged that gangs are behind this, which is a very, you know, Dunedin is a little rural town. It's if you imagine the United States, it's like somewhere out of New England. It's like, it's so goody two shoes on the surface, you wouldn't believe it. It's only when you start peeling behind, you realize it's the Stephen King novel. But, you know, we started to have these gang scenes occur, which is very new for us. And then the next thing you know, we start to get the arrival of a gang called the Bandidos, which is an international criminal fraternity organisation. They've arrived. I knew about this 2 weeks before it appeared in the Otago Daily Times. And the report that appeared in the Otago Daily Times was, this major super gang is coming to town. But don't worry about it, because gangs only hurt gangs. Nothing to fear. Move along. Now, within 15 metres of me is our octagon. It's the town centre. Over the last 3 weeks, me and many other people in my same community have sat back and we have watched these guys come in. They pull up in their $60,000 sports cars, their $75,000 Harley Davidsons. They're there every second day. You can see them riding up and down the town with patches. They're moving in. They're coming here to basically bring methamphetamine into this town, which has not managed to establish itself. And our system so far is sitting back and going, don't worry about it. You know, that's how corrupt it is. They don't even want to fight these guys. And these guys can stick a flag right in the middle of our octagon, because that's what they're doing, where they stick their Harley Davidsons there and they ride around the patches and they sit there drinking their beers, and we won't lift a finger. It takes guys like me to embarrass our police, to embarrass my fellow colleagues in the media before people start to do it. And this is what I do. This is where I come into play. I put footballs on the play field and I put them in a position where they say, you either act now, or else this goes on your record that you were warned and I did it in a very, very public way and you chose not to do anything. And there's nothing these guys fear more than embarrassment, and that is my strongest weapon against them. Their embarrassment and their fear of failure.
Well, they actually fear being exposed less than only one other thing. Even worse psychopaths than them.
Yep.
They follow even less rules.
Well, at the end of the day, they are more, they are afraid of these guys. And you know, at a localized level, I've sat there and I've watched police officers, big, you know, senior players of the gang movement come down here, get pulled over, police officers go to put their handcuffs, and then the big guys just literally shake their hands off. Police do this the second time, and the third time the police guys get back in the cars and drive off. It's just amazing. You know, and here I am, you know, like basically my paper will come out in about a week's time, and I've turned around and I've loaded a direct shotgun at the Bandidos and made it very clear in public what's going to happen. Now, you know, part of me should be scared shitless, and I actually am. But at the end of the day, the best defense you've got against those thugs is they are scum. They like to hide under rocks, and when they don't want to be dragged out to public. And in a way, I'm goading them. I want them to do something, because if they do, that's it. But then I force the other hands to take action.
Have you investigated possible connections between senior police and or council officials to the Bandido gang?
Well, on a local level, that's a subject which, I'll put it this way, right now I would rather not go there, because I simply haven't carried out the investigation at a local level, because this is very new. But if you want to take it from a wider scale, my first book, State Secrets, it goes fully into the whole connection between political government and organised crime. More frequently, we turn around, because the Bandidos, while they're doing this in Dunedin, they're also doing it in our second major city in the South Island, Christchurch. In Christchurch, the feedback that I'm getting continuously from my sources up there is that it's not just the gangs that are involved in this, they are working alongside the police. And this is no surprise to me, because again, I reported this back in my first book in 1919, State Secrets. I was told that there was no organised crime in New Zealand. In 2000, the New Zealand police released their first organised crime report, which identified over 375 criminal syndicates operating within New Zealand. Since that time, we have had several major senior police officers actually go down for drugs, criminal organised. So what I was told in 1999 was, oh no, that's rubbish, that doesn't happen in little old New Zealand, land of the hobbits. Now we take for granted it's actually, you know, even the police report on organised crime said these guys have infiltrated into every single branch of government that exists in New Zealand. And, you know, on top of that, if you flip that through to the US model, we make a comparison, this is not just about gangs and government. But, you know, in the United States, if you look at the methamphetamine trade, you have a situation where the major component that went into this meth was a cough mixture. In the United States, the law was changed so that basically those medicines or those components couldn't be made. Well, the firms, major firms, which were mostly Chinese-based or China-owned based in India, continued to make those pills. They were simply shipped out to Mexico, so that all along the Mexican border, the little pharmacy town, suddenly they went from being one pharmacy to having 400 pharmacies. The locals were shilling this meth, making, you know, the components which made meth. Those meths were being shipped into the United States, where they became a drain on the resources. Meanwhile, 90% of the weapons that were used or bought by the meth gangs in Mexico were made in China. So what does that tell you about the geopolitics of drugs?
Well, what about Fast and Furious, where Barack Obama signed off an operation to give Mexican drug cartels copious quantities of weapons, and then those weapons got found out to be in the United States, in the possession of the Mexican drug cartels, shooting U.S. police officers and towns?
Well, you're completely correct. And the thing is also, if for those who are familiar with the Iran-Contra and Bush politics, if you actually look at the rings that were used to smuggle weapons into the Nicaraguan-Contras back in the 80s, what you're seeing is a reemergence of those same rings. And, of course, the most famous one is the case where they formed a unit called CENTAC, which, don't ask me the alphabet, but this was a task force designed to go after the very top players. They had more than 90% of major convictions came from this task force, which had a very small budget. Well, under Bush, they shut this unit down. But in the records of CENTAC, it turned out that one of their officers got arrested. Well, Oliver North turns around and writes it up in his biography as that this guy was a bad guy, and he got, you know, basically his version was totally fabricated. It's only when we had the Iran-Contra and they reached him and they grabbed his emails that you realize actually they just made it up. They turned the good guys into the bad guys and the bad guys into the good guys. But that route back in the 80s is what we're now seeing happening now, and it's reflected in pop culture and things like Sons of Anarchy. You know, that Sons of Anarchy is a brilliant television series because it demonstrates you exactly the politics of US and New Zealand. The same thing that happens in America is happening here, and it's not new. It happened with Mr. Asia back in the 70s in New Zealand.
Now, can we say that this is not a reemergence, that theoretically it's been going on the whole time and only once in a while does it get exposed, that these types of things are not the exception, they're the rule?
Business as usual, baby. And, you know, again, if you study your politics or your history and you go back to the Opium Wars, which is, you know, companies like, well, you know, Jardines and a lot of these families, which, you know, people that are into the whole Illuminati history will be very familiar with. I just say, you know, families of influence, because that's the language I'm more comfortable with. This is the same tactics that they were using. They used on China and to take Hong Kong, and it's just repeated itself. And it's just, you know, it's a formula that works, so they continue using it. And at the end of the day, mm-hmm. there's a lot of money to be made in prohibition.
Well, if there's money involved and power involved, you have to assume that scumbaggery is involved.
There is scumbaggery involved at the highest levels. And again, this is the comment that was made in the CENTAC was, you know, the paraphrase, you said, you know, you don't have to be a CIA hater to be suspicious that every time you go to the State Department requesting handcuffs that you find guys in dark sunglasses dealing with the same bureaucrats offering them roses. And guess which ones win? You know, a lot of these guys, and this is fairly true in New Zealand as well, a lot of your major informants are actually the top players of the drug world, and what they're simply doing is they're using their status as informant to shut down their competition.
That's absolutely true, and not only that, but it works both ways. I heard an allegation that the New Zealand police will raid certain gangs on the say-so of their informant, and then they will steal that gang's drugs and then sell it to the informant in exchange for a favour of some description, for example, a contract killing. Have you heard anything like that?
Well, there's three particular points here, or three people I'd like to mention. Two of which I'll name and one of which I won't. When I was involved in the territorials, which is the American equivalent of the National Reserves, one of my postings was I worked in counterintelligence, and my commanding officer was Wendy Heath, who at that time was also an officer in the New Zealand Police. She was a CIB officer. Well, she, along a friend and a colleague of mine, Pat O'Brien, who today is a journalist, they turned around and they broke ranks along with, in fact, a third police officer who's also a colleague of mine, Peter Williams, and they broke ranks and they said, you know, we perjured our asses off. You know, we lied and we smoked drugs and we did all this bits and pieces and because we were told to do so. Fast forwarding, like, you know, in terms of people being hired to do contract killings, I've heard this on numerous bases, and the third person I was going to mention beforehand who is completely linked into the bar, to some of these businesses and bars that are the banditos are turned up in town. Well, this guy's job in the police was involved with the part that dealt with the gangs. Now, I had a third source come up to me one day and said, you know what that guy said to me? And I said, what? He said, look, you know how I've got that alteration with that other guy that's ripped me off? And I said, yeah, yeah. He said, well, he turned around and said, you know, why don't you go to court with this guy? Because we'll make sure he goes to jail and we'll send him to a Road Knight gang, which is one of our major gangs down here, and we'll make sure that he never comes out alive. So that's what this particular person, who was a former police officer involved in forming relationships with gangs, that's what he was telling other people.
Wow. Okay. I'm starting to get the picture now. Imagine for a moment that if somebody tells you that there is no corruption, that there's way more corruption than you could ever conceive possible, that there's so much that it would actually take you, I don't know, how long does a medical degree take? Like 7 years or something like that, of hardcore sleep deprivation-based mind control study in order to in order to kind of get the idea and be qualified and knowing what the heck you're talking about so you can actually diagnose disease and what have you? That's how bad the corruption is. There could be freaking an entire Auckland University library full of volumes using the Dewey Decimal System, cataloging and chronicling the massive obscene quantity of scumbaggery in New Zealand. Now, we're about to go to break, Ben. You've got one more thing to say and then we're going to go to break. We've got about a minute or so.
I'll say this. Corruption is so widespread in New Zealand that actually we don't see it as corruption. We have actually institutionalized it so that we think that this is morally acceptable conduct. That's how bad it's become. The Peter Williams, who is one of the police officers I spoke to, he wrote a book called Stone on Duty, and then he says we were so dumbed down to believe that there was no corruption that we created an environment in which corruption could thrive. New Zealand journalists all the time write out the fact that when Transparency International, which is a corruption watchdog, file a report on corruption in New Zealand, they always point out the fact that we get the top figure as being the least corrupt country in the world. What they don't report, and this is actual fact, the only reason why we have that ranking is that when those forms come into New Zealand, we don't fill them in, so we send them back to the body with no comments, and so we get a perfect zero. That's the only reason why we get such a great scoring.
It's because we're so corrupt that we don't fill out how much corruption that we've got, because the people who are supposed to be exposing corruption in New Zealand are corrupt.
And they're the ones that write the report.
Yeah.
It's the best way. If you have done something wrong and you want to make sure it's covered up, the best way to do it is make sure that you're in control of the corruption investigation.
Yeah.
And this is what Stone on Duty makes the point, is that he caught this particular detective on tape saying, look, Peter, you've got to leave it alone, because you've got to understand that the police complaints authority is set up there for one purpose, and that's to whitewash it to make sure that no mud sticks on us. So this is the body that's meant to protect New Zealanders, but the reality is all the police officers in the ranks know that this is there for one reason, and it's to protect their ass. We don't even have an internal – we're the only Western country in the world that doesn't have an internal affairs. Can you believe that?
I can, and I think that's why – the country is the way it is. Ben Vidgen is my very special guest, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you are capable of supporting the fight to get real information and expose the scumbaggery out there by different voices from all over the world, regardless of what media tell them that they're not credible and shouldn't be listened to and what have you, then go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and donate today. Or preferably start up a monthly automatic payment with that little Kiwi Bank or the PayPal. PayPal takes a percentage every time, but the Kiwi Bank doesn't. So automatic payments, it keeps all my rent and internet and stuff paid so that I can spend, the 14, 16, sometimes 18-hour days exposing scumbaggery and helping people's voices be heard. We'll be right back.